The following is the recording of the program of the Friends of the Library, dedication of the Special Collections Room of Malcolm A. Love Library at San Diego State University, held on January 23, 1988. The speakers are Ned Joy, Don Basso, and Owen Gingerich.
I'm going to be accused of speaking too loudly. We'll begin with some remarks from the University Librarian, Mr. Don Basso.
Thank you, Ned. I want to welcome everyone here. I'm glad to see such a nice turnout. This is a very special day at San Diego State University. Very special for the library and very special for the Special Collections and all of you who have contributed to the good cause, so to speak. If the books in this room could talk, not the right words. They do have a lot to say. But anyway, they have been spread all over this building. They've been on several floors, and they finally have a permanent home. And like I say, if they could speak, I'm sure that they would express more appreciation than I can say here today. But we do want to express our appreciation, and I'm speaking on behalf of the university, the library staff, and many friends of the library when I say that we are very, very happy and very gracious to have received the help that we've had in getting this room, getting it furnished, and getting all of the Special Collections books in one home base. I think that it's taken a while. I know it's certainly strained my patience at times. Dealing with the state bureaucracy workings isn't always fast, but usually it ends up very well. So in this case it did. Thank you very much for being here, and thanks for your help.
Well, my happy duty to try to thank all those who have been specifically helpful in this enterprise. I'm going to keep it as brief as I can, but there are so many who have done so much that I cannot overlook many of them. First, the committee. We always proceed with committees at universities. Was appointed to work out this program. It consists of Lou Kenny, Lynn Olson, Alice Filler, Carmelie, Nancy Dolso, and Ruth Lierhoff, all of whom gave of their time and energy and served us well. Ruth Lierhoff in particular badgered me repeatedly until we got the picture molding installed with the help of my son Patrick Joy. When we arrived, I thought I had in mind that I was in charge, but soon thereafter I discovered my role was that of gopher and picker-upper. Not exactly what I had in mind. But anyway, we got the job done, I hope. Steve and Sidney Gulick are not able to be here this morning, having awakened with sore throats and I fear the beginning of the flu. But I have to express particular thanks for the beautiful a tapestry that is hanging on the east wall of the room, a proof of the weaving skills of Eve Gulick. They bring a wonderful touch to the room, and we're very grateful for the contribution. Sidney Gulick is not here, but I have to mention that when he was Dean of Arts and Sciences, and one of his responsibilities was the university library, he went to the then rather new librarian, Dr. Kenny, and said, "We ought to have a Friends of the Library." And they agreed, and that was the launching of the enterprise that now has grown to this level of achievement. We're honored today particularly by having Hamilton Marston, our very first president of the Friends, among our guests. There are some persons I need to thank for their generosity and their contributions to the achievements of the Friends. Alvina Storm has given very generously to the room fund. Alvina joined the faculty when it was the State Teachers College, located in a building at the west end of El Cajon Boulevard. Moved out to this mesa when there were a few handsome buildings in Mission style that are still at the heart of the campus, and dirt roads in which the faculty mm-hmm. occasionally bogged down in the mud. She saw a change from State Teachers College to State College to university. And she was a grand lady and was very generous. Theodore and Betty Tate must be mentioned particularly because of their generosity and because Ted served us in so many different ways. He was president twice. He took on any chore, any assignment, and carried it off with a flair. And many of you will remember the quality of the bulletin of the Friends that was circulated in those when he was the editor. He loved to put that bulletin together. He did a beautiful job. And we are the richer for his having been among us. I want to also take the time to thank some persons who have been very generous by the donation of collections. Elizabeth Chater, who is with us today, I'm so pleased, gave a very nice collection of science fiction. And when Elizabeth retired, she took to writing and has just published her 23rd volume. Retirement is very good for some folks. Amy Jo Wormser gave us, I think, our most valuable collection, and I never am able to describe its content except to say that it is really awe-inspiring to see the quality of the works which she gave us. And Professor and Mrs. Calvert Norman have given us some a distinguished collection in the history of the biological sciences. Cal Norland, by the way, is recovering from surgery and cannot be here today, but he's coming along fine. There's one other person to be mentioned, and I'm sure that person is here, although I do not see the person. A longtime member of the Friends, longtime member of the board, generous in time and in contributions, and particularly generous in the support for the development of our rooms. But even more important than these things, our distinguished member was important for having pushed us all to take advantage of opportunities and to worry about details later. Those details often involve finding the money to pay for things. But no one has done more to increase the quality of the collection and to inspire the members of the Friends to achieve more than they otherwise would. We owe a very special debt to Helen Marcy Johnson. To introduce the speaker. Dr. Owen Gingerich earned his MA and PhD at Harvard University.
He has a list of publications that is impressive. He is now professor of astronomy and history of science at Harvard University, and astrophysicist at the Smithsonian Astrophysics Observatory. He has used the Zinner collection in our library. He has given generously of his advice, and he honors us by his presence. Dr. Owen Ginger.
When I saw that this room was going to be dedicated at precisely the time that my wife and I were already planning to be in Southern California, almost nothing could keep us away. We were keen to come and help share with you the opening of this special collection that has a special place in my own research because, as a historian of astronomy, I find that the Zinner collection contains some very interesting and even unique materials in it. I met Ernst Zinner only once when he was an old man, and although I'm sure he commanded English quite well for his research purposes, he didn't actually speak it. So I can't say, since my German was even worse than his English, that we had much communication. But it was interesting to meet him back in 1965 before he died. And then his collection has come here to form the basis of the early science part of the special collections. I'm going to talk to you this morning about a question that Zinner would have been much interested in. I've taken as my title Circles of the Gods, Copernicus, Kepler, and the Ellipse. The first part of it comes from a recent book by a university, Louisville seminary professor's book. His name is Harold Nebelsick, and in his book called Circles of the Gods, he says that the perfection of the circle was a theological idea that came from the ancient Greeks, that this held astronomy in thrall for many centuries, and only with the breaking of this belief by Kepler could science free itself from such constraints and could begin to make real progress. I was rather critical of this notion because it seems to me that the circle is exactly the place to begin if you wish to represent celestial motions. The notion that the heavens were eternal and that a circle, which goes round and round forever, was the pattern to use to represent the heavens was not a bad one. And in fact, you can represent the heavens pretty much as closely as you want if you use the proper combination of circles. So it seemed to me that the idea of using a circle as a starting point to represent celestial motions was really a rather good one, and that I thought Nebelsick's arguments against this were really badly misplaced. I wrote a critical review of the book and then forgot about it. But recently I was given a manuscript to read from what will no doubt be a very widely selling popular book on astronomy that will cover the scope of it from antiquity to modern times. And according to this account, Copernicus made a mighty leap forward when he turned away from a geocentric universe to a heliocentric universe, but that he was shackled by his failure to find the ellipse, and that hence his astronomy was fundamentally flawed. The same argument that Nebelsick had used with respect to Copernicus. And this all upset me enough that I decided I would address myself to this topic, because I think that's all nonsense. Both Ptolemy and Copernicus could get just as much accuracy from their model with circles as was needed for the particular accuracy of observations that were available to them. It was not until Tycho Brahe that one got observations that were sufficiently precise that one could, in fact, just barely tell the difference between a circle and an ellipse for the motion of the planets, and that within 10 years of the time when those accurate observations became available, Kepler had in fact found and announced the elliptical orbits of the planets. So I cannot see that in any way Copernicus was a failure for not finding something that he could not possibly have found, because he simply didn't have the observations available. Now that's it, folks. That's my whole speech. Now I will proceed to embroider on it. So if we can turn on the slide projector and turn off the lights, I will show you a little bit more about what I have in mind here. I begin with Johannes Kepler, who is in some ways the hero of our particular talk today. And one of the reasons is to show you one of the known images of Kepler. I think eventually the lights will disappear. I'm reminded of all this imagery of Kepler because recently a company printed an advertisement that had a picture of Kepler in the advertisement, which was obviously not Kepler. And out there, the great reading public, somebody noticed this and got sufficiently annoyed to write the company a nasty letter. And they turned it over to their advertising agency, which happens to be located here in San Diego, and they said, but we got this from a really good archive. I was interested. I don't know if they got it from the Zinner collection or not, but that would have been a good starting point. But back in 1932, Zinner wrote an article about the images of Kepler, and in it, he showed the one which was used in the advertisement, and he explained that although this had been identified as Kepler, this was entirely false. It was actually Maximilian X of Bavaria. The advertising company, you know, turned to me to find out what they had done wrong, and I had to research this to find out, in fact, how many honest images of Kepler we've got. Well, I guess I'll say we have 4.5. And this is the half. This was found in a castle in Czechoslovakia around the time of the 400th anniversary of Kepler's birth in 1971. It looks enough like the other pictures of him, and the date of the portrait and so on is about right, so I think it might very well be Kepler. But it isn't 100% authenticated. Well, all right, so much for Kepler. Here's what he did. This shows you the ellipse. Now, the ellipse is basically an off-centered circle. Now you say, oh, isn't that? It's all squashed in. But for all of the planets, the difference between the off-centered circle and the ellipse is about the size of the pencil line if you're drawing on an ordinary sheet of paper. Because unless you have a great deal of eccentricity on the ellipse, it doesn't begin to bow in. What is absolutely crucial, however, is the second law that Kepler discovered, which is the law of areas, which tells us that the planet, as it goes around in its ellipse, sweeps out equal areas in equal times. So that when it's far from the sun, it doesn't need to move so far to make an ellipse, to make a triangle of the same area that it does over here when it's close to the sun. In modern physics, we know that this is an accurate representation of what we call the law of conservation of angular momentum, which has many practical applications, among others being championship skating, where you see the skater with his arms and leg out to get the maximum amount of this angular momentum, even though he's turning only very little. But when he pulls his arms in, he then speeds up a great deal because of this conservation law, the conservation of angular momentum. Unfortunately, my flash was so fast, it has caught him still. He should, of course, be a blur as he's spinning around. The one thing you can see is the way his hair spins out in that almost like a little halo there. So he is actually in a very rapid spin at this particular point. Well, you cannot get to first base in talking about planets unless you do something in your model that will account for the conservation of angular momentum. Now that's anachronistic. That's a modern term. Ptolemy, who is seen here as he appears in the church in Ulm in Germany, did not know about angular momentum. He would have been baffled if you'd used that word. But he knew that he had to do something when he was modeling the planets, because they went sometimes faster and sometimes slower, and I'll show you how he did it. Here is a manuscript. This was formerly in the Honeyman collection up at San Juan Capistrano, and long ago before that, the manuscript belonged to Michael Mestlin, who happened to be the teacher of Johannes Kepler. This is the representation of how Ptolemy made the planets move. Sometimes the planets go backwards in the sky, the so-called retrograde motion. We needn't worry about that very much, but let me just say that Ptolemy did it by having a second circle here, which was this epicycle, would cause the planet to come in, swing around in the loop, go backwards before it began to go forward. But the part I want to talk about, the unequal motion, Ptolemy did in a different way by what he called the equant. Here you have the Earth off-center, and you see right away that this is a kind of approximation to the ellipse, because he's putting the Earth off-center, not the Sun, but it converts out to be very much the same thing. Here's the center of the circle, the so-called deferent or carrying circle. It's got the same root in it as ferry has, the F-E-R. The deferent carries the epicycle around, but here is the seat of uniform motion. So that if this is a planet with a period of 4 years, let's say, it will move through 90 degrees in 1 year, it will move the next 90 degrees in another year, and so on around. But because the equant is placed up here, it means that the epicycle moves slowly here, and in the next 90 degrees, it has so much farther to go, it's going to move faster and faster. So it moves rapidly here and slowly up at this end. And Ptolemy, without actually knowing it, what he was doing was making a very good approximation for the conservation of angular momentum. But all he was doing was trying to represent the planets as he observed them, and he knew they were going faster to one side than the other, and that's how he did it. And it was remarkably accurate. He didn't have such perfect observations. You must understand that occasionally he got them to within 10 minutes of arc. That would be about a third the size of the moon in the sky, but often his observations were even less accurate than the diameter of the moon. So he didn't have very good material to work with, but his instruments were not so great, and of course he had no telescopic sights. We turn now to a figure from Spain in the Middle Ages, in the 13th century. This is Alfonso the X, Alfonso the Wise, and this is a very official representation of him, because this is the medallion in the U.S. House of Representatives, where great lawgivers are represented up around the balustrade of the balcony. And so here is King Alfonso, and he was a great patron of the arts and the sciences. And he sponsored a series of tables and other astronomical treatises. And here's an example of a section of the Alfonsine tables. This is a manuscript copy of it. And if you look at these tables very carefully, you see that they're very closely based on the earlier work of Claudius Ptolemy, who worked in the 2nd century AD. Now, there's a very famous anecdote about Alfonso that he is said to have told his astronomers that had he been around at creation, he could have given the good Lord some hints. The implication being that it was so complicated with all those circles, he would have certainly made things a little bit simpler. And this has given rise to the notion that somehow the astronomers of the Middle Ages observing faithfully and getting it more and more accurate, had been unable to settle just for that big epicycle you saw that Ptolemy had, and they had then little epicycles riding on the big epicycle and so on down the line. I think this is a notion that came in the last century when a French mathematician named Fourier showed that you could represent a mathematical graph as exactly as you wanted by a whole long trigonometric series, where adding another trigonometric term to the approximation made it increasingly accurate, which would be like adding yet another circle to the circular approximation of the heavenly motions. Well, this is just entirely fictitious, because it turns out that there was very little observing going on during the Middle Ages, and that there simply were no mathematicians clever enough to figure out how you would have been able to add another epicycle to the existing one. Ptolemy had used such beautiful mathematical tricks based on the idea that there was just a single epicycle. This would have botched up the whole structure of the system. So if you had tried that, it wouldn't have worked. I have made a computer analysis of these tables. It's perfectly plain that they're very simple in pure Ptolemy. And here is an ephemeris, which was published while Copernicus was a youngster. It's an incunabulum of the ephemerides of Regiomontanus. And again, I have duplicated these with the computer and show that they're in turn pure Alphonsine, based on the simple Alphonsine tables. So at the time of Copernicus, one had still essentially the basic simple astronomy of Ptolemy in hand. Yet the rumor has come that Copernicus had made a vast simplification. And I suppose in part it stems from this little tract that Copernicus wrote. He handed it around to some friends. We have no original copy, but this is one of the copies made in the 16th century of it. And it ends by saying, "Behold, the entire ballet of the planets can be accomplished with only 34 circles." And I fixed my camera to its sharpest right there on the 34. Somehow this was understood as saying that Ptolemy had so many circles, and I, Copernicus, have managed to get it down to only 34. In reality, Copernicus was using more circles than Ptolemy. What he was excited about was that just simply the motions in the heaven appeared to be so complicated, and yet, with only 34 circles, he could make a very fine representation of it. Copernicus said that if he could represent all of the planets within 10 minutes of arc, that is to say, one-third the diameter of the moon, he would be as happy as could be. And that was approximately the accuracy of his best observations, but many of them were much poorer, and for the most part, he used Ptolemy's observations. He believed that this was a great heritage from antiquity, and he couldn't dare doubt that those were precise and good observations. So his astronomy was essentially not that much better in terms of accuracy than Ptolemy's. Nevertheless, it had, let me just skip on to the next slide, it had a very important effect of simplification. Ptolemy had to use two circles to represent Mars, the big deferent circle and the epicycle. Well, so did Copernicus. He had to use the orbit of the Earth and the orbit of Mars. But when he turned to Venus, which Ptolemy required two circles to do, Copernicus had to use two circles, but one of them was the same, the orbit of Venus and the orbit of the Earth. He was able to use the orbit of the Earth over and over again, which essentially connected together all of the disparate, separate mechanisms that Ptolemy had for each individual planet. So the great accomplishment of Copernicus was getting it all linked together. Now let me back up, since this is a meeting in celebration of books. I thought I should show you Copernicus's library. It